In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Usable news and information for your job. And now, here's Francis Rose.
Thanks for listening on Friday, August 16th, 2013, on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And federalnewsradio.com. Today, it's the Federal News Countdown, as we do every Friday in the 3 o'clock hour. And I have two experts in the world of the federal government. Each of them has chosen the news stories they think are the most important to people who work for the federal government. And we have a rookie and a veteran on the countdown. The rookie is Steve Bucci of the Heritage Foundation. Steve, it's great to see you. Thank you for doing this. I hope you have a good time today.
I hope so. I'm looking forward to it.
You've chosen great stories. And our veteran is Dan Mintz. And you are the president of AMARC. And what is that?
AMARC is the Advanced Mobility Academic Research Center. It's a nonprofit to create a community of interest between academic institutions and the government around mobile technology.
And that's a new thing, and we'll put some information about that at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, along with all the stuff from the countdown today. You've each chosen your stories. We'll have those linked up later today as well on the in-depth page, and we start, like we always do, with... And Steve Bucci, your third most important federal news story of the week is from Politico Pro. The headline is Cuts Prompt DOD to Lower Sights on New Drones. And this is happening as everybody in the drone world is here in Washington this week for the big drone conference that they said, please don't call it drones. So this is, they want us to call them now, they don't even want us to call it unmanned vehicles anymore. It's, the whole terminology is changing.
Well, and some of this is just because of the bad press that they've gotten overseas with the targeted killings where they've used unmanned aerial vehicles as the platform to carry the weapons, and the debate here in the States and sort of the missteps by the Attorney General saying, oh, yeah, of course we could use them to kill Americans.
Whoops.
I picked this story just because I think the subject of drones is so important. It's a big technology. It's growing quicker and quicker, and it saves money. It potentially can save lives. It improves our capabilities, but lots and lots of social debate about their use and their efficacy. So that's why I picked this one.
The policy issue here, too, is that this is totally unplowed ground. I mean, there are a lot of issues here. These are essentially, I have heard them described as flying computers. And so Moore's Law applies here. And soon it will be practical for you or I to go and buy these and look at our neighbors' barbecues. And the implications are really immense. And nobody seems to be wrapping their ears and arms around the domestic implications of these devices.
Well, and on one hand, you're right. On the other hand, I disagree. This technology really, the only difference is there's nobody sitting in them. Mm-hmm. They're being controlled somewhere else. We're not yet talking about autonomous drones where they're just flying on their own. There's somebody with a stick somewhere steering them and watching where they go. And, you know, even overseas or domestically, the laws and rules that we have still apply as far as, you know, police using them. There's no difference between flying one of these and flying around in a police helicopter other than more police departments could afford them. So if your kid gets lost in the woods, your local police might actually have a capability to go look for them, whereas today only the biggest law enforcement agencies can afford these things. So I think we need to get our heads wrapped around what still applies of existing law and policy and what is new and what we do still need to sort out.
How do you start that process? How do you determine what laws are on the books that might not look obvious that they would apply to drone technology but actually could?
Well, you just the easiest way is to just let the cases pop up and let it go through our judicial review process and let the system work the way it actually has worked for 200 some years. A lot of people are not satisfied with that. They get very nervous and they want to preemptively remove things from the table, which I think is unwise. I think these technologies, there's so much good that can come of them. To preemptively throw them out because something bad might happen is just not wise. I think we let the process go through, and as a case comes up and someone thinks it's out of whack, then we take it to the courts and we fight it out and let the different levels of the judiciary make the decision.
Now, the analogy that you used about the application of drones in a police or law enforcement environment is it parallels exactly what this piece is about, in that there may be applications that the military will apply drones where optimally they would like to have manned aircraft and can't because they can't afford it anymore.
And that's what's sort of interesting about this. We're at a time of fiscal austerity. You would think we would be embracing all of these less expensive technologies, but these are some of the things that the military is recognizing they're not going to get, because in some cases they're protecting existing programs. In other cases, they're just not ready to take the chance on a new technology that may in fact save them money. I think this is an area they should actually be pushing forward on, not backing off.
Steve Bucci's third most important federal news story of the week is from Politico Pro. The headline is Cuts Prompt DOD to Lower Sights on New Drones. And you can read it and all of our stories linked later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dan Mintz, your third most important story of the week is from GCN. The headline is Mobile Apps Are Key to VA's New Models of Care Program. And this program in and of itself is interesting, and you can read about it through the link on our site later today. But it speaks to me, and probably to you, I'm guessing, about a broader application of apps for government, no pun intended.
Yes, and in fact, when you go to the link to the story, you also can go to some YouTube videos. The veterans are doing some very interesting work with that. So there are two things that I think are very interesting. First of all, it's something that we've talked about before, and that is, with all of these kinds of initiatives, the power of the initiative comes from the application, that is the mission activity. And even though efficiency and saving money is an admirable goal, it's not what really drives investments. In this case, this is getting traction because it's tied very tightly to one of the missions of the Veterans Administration. And that allows it to go forward. The other thing is more and more agencies, not just veterans, and this is true across the government, are recognizing that it makes sense to focus on app development, exposing the way to get at data, creating app stores where you can buy these stores. And in fact, this article talks about how the Veterans Administration is setting up standards around their app store in terms of how to do this. So in one sense, this is a very good thing. This kind of activity is going on, and there's a lot of emphasis, and it's remarkable how fast this has changed. The negative side about this, in the same way that you had stovepipes of data, where the data was not communicable, there is no reason without planning that you're not going to have stovepipes of app development, mm-hmm. where the app approach and app development to the Veterans Administration will be sufficiently different than DOD or sufficiently different from DHS and so on and so forth, that you won't be able to communicate amongst them, even though the data may have overlap.
And the other fear that I have when it comes to stovepipes is that these apps will be placed in such a way, if each agency has its own app store, they will be segregated, that you'll have to be consciously aware of the fact that if you want to get apps that interact together, if they were made by different agencies, you have to go to each one of those app stores individually. Apple demonstrated, and Google has replicated, the fact that the beauty of the app store is you go to one location to find all of these different things that you want to use. Some of them work together, and some of them don't. But that's not the model that I see happening if every agency has its own apps store.
Yeah. I would think that this might be a good place that the CIO Council could play a government-wide role.
Well, and GSA has established an app store that was the idea behind this, and it, for whatever reason, hasn't taken off.
And I think it has to be done at the OMB level. And so, for example, in industry, when you have, you know, when Sun Microsystems, who I work for, want to standardize around Java, even though they retained a certain amount of control, they created an industry consortium around it that would have to approve standards. And there were other more open or open standards like TCP/IP networking standards, where there were industry consortia. So that if there was development, the consortia had to approve it. OMB can consider using the CIO Council as a mechanism to create a government consortia. Which meant that if you're going to do apps, rather than approving it internally at one agency, it would have to be done by this government-wide group.
Dan Mintz's third most important federal news story of the week on this week's Federal News Countdown is mobile apps key to VA's new models of care program. It's from GCN, Nate Woolley's story there, and you can read it later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important federal news stories of the week on the countdown as chosen by Dan Mintz and Steve Bucci, and we'll continue in a moment on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
Has sequestration and budget cuts made performing vital IT functions difficult for your agency? If so, it's time to explore another option with SUSE Linux, the open source leader. Save time and money by lowering the cost of your operating system and associated products with SUSE's expanded support program. It's the fastest way to save money on your next Linux renewal and lower the cost of licensing without changing any of your applications or systems. Learn more at SUSE.com/spendless. That's SUSE.com/spendless. Or purchase on SUPE through CDWG.
The Cybersecurity Report is brought to you by University of Maryland University College.
Last week, August 6th, 10:24 a.m., a critical day during what was called the biggest threat from Al-Qaeda since 9/11. Secret Service tweeted, contact your nearest field office with time-sensitive or critical information or to report a tweet. Some questioned the solicitation. But it happened the day before WikiLeaks posted a tweet telling former NSA Director Mike Hayden cyber terrorists would destroy him if Edward Snowden were extradited. I'm J.J. Green.
Secure your future with a bachelor's or master's degree in cybersecurity, available entirely online from University of Maryland University College. Their programs have been specially developed by experts from government and private industry, so you'll get the real-world skills you need for your career. Plus, UMUC is designated as a National Center of Academic Excellence in Information Assurance Education by NSA and DHS. University of Maryland University College. Call 800-888-UMUC or visit UMUC.edu.
Tom Temin here with a preview of Monday's Federal Drive. Veterans Affairs and Defense Department team up with leading academic researchers to boost understanding of post-traumatic stress and brain injuries. And high-level officials are leaving the government all over and finding big private sector jobs. Jason Miller has a roundup of the latest ones in his reporter's notebook. Those stories and much more Monday morning starting at 6 on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. And for all the latest federal news, be sure to visit federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com, the Federal News Countdown featuring the three most important news stories of the week as selected by Dan Mintz and Steve Bucci, and we're up to
number two.
And Steve, your second most important story of the week is from the National Review Online. The headline is Preventing Future Snowdens. Should Congress provide safe harbor to intelligence whistleblowers? And I'm seeing some really interesting reaction to this question of what do we do to keep this from happening again? This is, we're talking about Snowden at the same time that Bradley Manning is sentenced, or is about to be sentenced. And all of that is happening too. What I keep hearing as an underlying theme of this is there are going to be more. There's nothing we can do to prevent them. So it becomes a risk management question as much as it becomes a security or information isolation question. Where are you on this?
The reason I picked this story was it's just such an important question. There are going to be more people. I don't think Snowden or Manning were whistleblowers. They leaked stuff. They broke the law. And they should be prosecuted. But given that there's going to be more of this, there is a question, not with Manning. His was sort of, I think, more cut and dry. With Snowden, where could he have gone when he had these problems, when it's highly classified, special programs? And right now there isn't a place where these folks feel they can go to and get some sort of recourse. We've got to have that, or we're going to just run into these problems where it ends up in The Guardian and The Washington Post all the time, and that's not acceptable for national security.
The idea that there will be more is not really a technology question, Dan. It's a spy question, and we've had spies, and we have used spies of our own for as long as we've been before we were a country. And countries have historically used spies throughout all of recorded history. So I wonder why there was, at first at least, a rush to say, well, we want to stop this from ever happening again. Of course it's going to happen again. Somebody will do it.
Well, there's two things. Well, first of all, the attempt to stop all leaks, you can go back a long time and read about presidents and administrations that want to stop all leaks one way or another. So that's just the way it goes. I think this is what's going on here is part of the much broader problem associated with cybersecurity, again, that we've talked about before, where historically when you had conflict, the bad guys were geographically in one place, the good guys were geographically in another place, and then to get one to the other, you had to cross a border of some sort. And then the problem you have in warfare right now in general is, of course, the lack of a border. Everything is everywhere. Well, that's the same thing here. Not only do you have the problem that you don't have some place to go, the definition of what constitutes security and what constitutes really something that needs to be protected starts to become hard to handle. You know, I agree what was said about the attitude toward both Snowden and Manning, but then you look at some of the things that have been exposed by Snowden and just look at those. Some of them are discomforting. And cross very blurry lines in terms of what's appropriate and inappropriate.
And from the cyber standpoint, in both these cases, it's not so much that these were cyber incidents, but the capability we have through digital media makes it way easier to do this stuff. I mean, Bradley Manning would have had to have 2.5 trucks to take away all the paper documents that he gave away on a couple of writable discs.
Mm-hmm.
That's a problem. Same thing with Snowden. I mean, the stuff that he took, it would have been much harder for him to go and steal paper files. So cyber now enables people and gives them the capability to do this stuff more readily.
But the whole idea that this was a cyber problem was what we first heard about when we learned about Snowden. This is a cyber violation. I mean, and people focused on that. Was that, do you think, just a media phenomenon, or was that something? Is that the way that people thought about it inside the world of intelligence and information security too?
I don't think it was a cyber thing, other than the fact that the NSA has this highly classified, compartmented website or database that they put all their quote admin stuff, which is what Snowden got into to get these briefings and documents.
Mm-hmm.
It's just the way we're organized to manage information today makes it very vulnerable to this type of action.
You know, when you have somebody who's worked at a place for less than a year, who didn't even graduate college, and has access enough to take everything he took, I don't think that's a cyber problem. That's a different kind of problem. You know, when I was at DOT, I used to joke that one of the big problems with security is there are too many secrets. And while that's a joke to some extent, I believe our intelligence community is going to have to wrestle with that, there's only so much that they're going to be able to protect. So what do they do about that?
And prioritizing what they protect and the degree to which they protect it seems to be something. I mean, we obviously can't speak to it because we don't know the parameters that are set within the IC. But the sense that we see from what we learned from Snowden is that there's not a lot of that going on right now. Is that fair to say?
Well, you know, you have to keep in mind that, you know, this is one guy out of, you know, thousands and thousands of people, contractors, government people, military people, intel community people who have these clearances, who deal with this kind of information all the time, who don't break any rules. You know, keep in mind that the most egregious spies we've ever had in our country, you know, Robert Hansen, Aldridge Ames, had the highest security class or clearances they could have, you know, years of experience. It's almost a red herring to worry about the contractor versus the other stuff. But I do agree with Dan. There should be less classification. We classify stuff way too readily, way too high, mostly because it's convenient, and then it's harder to protect it because there's just so much of it to protect.
Well, it strikes me, too, that there is stuff that may be it may be necessary to classify for a period of time, but a far shorter period of time than we are able to do it now. Is that a volume question, or is that a quality of intelligence question, or what is that? What is the answer there, do you think?
So being the nun, I would actually even push back a little bit in terms of the broad issue. I believe that the intelligence, again, I think government agencies and people in general and the intelligence community needs to think a little bit more about the fact that the premise that something will be kept secret is likely to be a false premise. It doesn't mean you shouldn't have security. It doesn't mean things don't have to be classified. But if your security program is based fundamentally on things being completely secure, I think it'll fail. So you need a more agile kind of approach to these things that can deal with these kinds of leakages.
I'm sorry. I agree completely with that. But we got to make sure we don't go all the way to the other end. And I've had discussions with folks publicly about this as well, saying, well, we just need 100% transparency. We can't have any of these kind of secrets. You know, the government writing. I mean, come on. You can't conduct diplomacy by telling the people you're reporting on everything you're about to write on them. You can't conduct security operations. You can't fight terrorism. You can't fight a war if you're going to publicly display, you know, the operations order for the invasion of Normandy should not get published in the Berlin Times during World War II. But that's what some of these people think we should be doing, and that's just crazy.
Steve Bucci's second most important federal news story of the week is a commentary on National Review Online called Preventing Future Snowdens, Should Congress Provide Safe Harbor to Intelligence Whistleblowers? And you can read it later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. Dan Mintz's choice for the second most important federal news story of the week is next on the Federal News Countdown on In-Depth with Francis Rose.
True innovation means anticipating challenges before they occur. Lockheed Martin was early to recognize the changing nature of naval warfare. New types of threats in coastal waters called for a new kind of combat ship. We responded with deep thinking for shallow waters, designing the littoral combat ship with speed, agility, and the most networked sensors of any surface combatant. And to make sure commanders stay one step ahead of evolving missions, the LCS is built on a flexible C-frame with interchangeable mission modules. It offers the operational flexibility to execute focused missions such as anti-submarine, mine, and surface warfare, providing access and dominance in the coastal battle space like never before. The LCS is one more example of our ongoing commitment to those who are meeting the security challenges of today and tomorrow. Lockheed Martin. We never forget who we're working for.
Here's Gil Vega, Chief Information Security Officer, Department of Energy, on the Federal Executive Forum on Cybersecurity, sponsored by McAfee.
Self-awareness of your infrastructure, if done correctly and efficiently, can really strengthen and converge your insider threat program with your cybersecurity program. And I think that's the vision for all federal agencies, to be able to converge on those two main issues.
To listen to the whole program made possible by Trezza Media Group, log on to federalnewsradio.com.
Federal IT organizations and prime contractors are experiencing a rapid rise in cybersecurity threats and compliance requirements. McAfee is the standard throughout federal military, intelligence, and civilian enterprises worldwide. McAfee's capabilities are essential to assuring federal networks remain resilient against the latest cyber threats. To learn more about how McAfee can help your organization combat cybersecurity threats, call 888-VIRUS-NO or go to McAfee.com/government.
Overdose among women. From the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, I'm Ira Dreyfuss with HHS HealthBeat. A study by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention finds that more and more women are dying from overdoses of prescription drugs. Researcher Karen Mack.
Mothers, wives, sisters, and daughters are dying from these overdoses at rates never seen before. Prescription painkiller overdose deaths increased fivefold among women between 1999 and 2010.
Mack says more than 6,600 women died in 2010 from prescription painkiller overdose. Men are still more likely to die from overdoses, but women are catching up fast. Previous research shows that women are more likely than men to have chronic pain, to get painkillers at higher doses, and to use them for longer periods. The study is in the CDC's Morbidity and Mortality Weekly Report. Learn more at healthfinder.gov. HHS HealthBeat is a production of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. I'm Ira Dreyfuss.
The Federal News Radio United Way Charity of the Month is the Alzheimer's Association. More than 5 million Americans have Alzheimer's disease. Everyone is at risk, even you. Everyone can help, especially you. That's why the Alzheimer's Association needs you to do one little thing today. Call, donate, or advocate in any way you can. With your help, they can provide better support and find a breakthrough in your lifetime. For more info, visit federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Radio charities are fed by Papa John's.
Now for your Federal News Radio cybersecurity update. Afternoons at 30 minutes after the hour. IBM is strengthening its cloud security portfolio by buying Trusteer. The cost of the financial fraud and advanced security threats prevention provider were not disclosed. However, IBM did announce the creation of a cybersecurity software lab in Israel as part of the deal. You get your cybersecurity update afternoons at 30 minutes after the hour on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
This is In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Steve Bucci and Dan Mintz. And Dan, your second most important story of the week is Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com, headline DHS to standardize cyber protections through new contract. And it includes some of Jason's conversation with John Stroyfert, the Director of Network Resilience at DHS. What you see here, is this a good news story for agencies, or is there potential here for another stovepipe situation like we've talked about?
Well, one would never want to bet against stovepipe solutions or results. I think this is it's both good and interesting. So people understand, DHS was, the Congress authorized setting up what they call continuous diagnostics and mitigation tools. So this is in that context, and this is a contract to do that. Stroyfert has got agreements with all but one of the CFO organizations. GSA is the one they hadn't, and they should have that shortly to do the networking. And the thought being that they'll protect the network first as a whole, and then take care of the applications that sit on top of it. So I think there's two points to derive from this. The first is it's amazing how fast, and I think in a good way, the focus has moved away from a static review of security, the FISMA standard that certainly I was familiar with when I was in government, to continuous monitoring. And you can argue, is it great or just merely an improvement? I think it's an improvement, certainly, in attitude in terms of approach. That is, you're not trying to find out about a system every 3 years, but you're trying to keep some kind of track of it all the time. And there are questions, of course, in terms of what you do when you find out about it. The second thing that's interesting is this is to be provided as a service. I'll ignore the fact that, you know, when I was in the dot-com boom, when I worked for Sun Microsystems, the old joke was you could buy a potato with sour cream .com. So in this case, you can buy anything as a service. So there's a little bit of a danger of that. But the fact is, this emphasizes doing it relatively consistently across the government in some fashion and not by the agencies, that is being provided from an external source. Mm-hmm. And that's even more remarkable. And I think it's a compliment to the OMB and the two CIOs that this administration has had to change the dynamic so quickly from you know, hugging systems to moving and being willing to at least attempt to have these services provided externally. That's a big cultural change for the government to even consider.
Steve, you like what you see here?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, continuous monitoring is really the only chance we have to secure these big networks. I mean, it's where it's been tried before. It's never really been continuous. It's always been like very frequent monitoring. But even that is better than the static stuff that was mentioned that we had in the past under FISMA. And the government, bless their hearts, you know, they tried to come up with this themselves. The Department of State sort of built their own. It's kind of languished in the last couple of years. The private sector has the motivation to do this, has the capability to come up with as good a system as we can get today, but keep it dynamic enough to make it work as we move into the future. This is really the way the government and the private sector need to go, and fortunately they're moving in the right direction.
As this rolls out, I'm thinking about the same kind of spread that you're thinking about, Dan, which is we're already headed toward fill in the blank as a service, and the danger is that it turns into a catchphrase or a buzzword that a year from now or 2 years from now doesn't really mean anything and doesn't really necessarily serve the government or the taxpayer very well.
Well, so I think that's not a huge danger. The government's going to have to wrestle through how to do things as a service well. How do they get sign off on security protections and things like that? But in general, it's all positive development. I mean, I've said over and over again that the power of any investment in the government, and let's talk about IT, the power of IT investment becomes authoritative when it's directly supporting the mission. If the IT professionals are spending all their time running data centers and dealing with infrastructure details, you can buy that. But you can't buy people who have experience with the mission of the organization and understand how to provide those services in support of the mission. The goal needs to be over time to use these very, very limited resources to support mission activity and buy the services from a commodity provider from the outside. And I think this is a sea change that the people involved should be complimented on.
The second most important federal news story of the week, as selected by Dan Mintz, is Jason Miller's story on federalnewsradio.com, headline DHS to Standardize Cyber Protections Through New Contract. And that story includes Jason's interview with Director of Network Resilience at DHS, John Stroyford. You can find it and all of our countdown stories at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. The most important federal news stories of the week is selected by Dan Mintz and Steve Bucci. When we come back on this week's Federal News Countdown on In Depth with Francis Rose.
Life is filled with uncertainty, military life especially. AFMA can help you breathe easy through it all. Since 1879, AFMA has helped military families with low-cost military life insurance and the best survivor assistance. We're experts at helping you manage the complexities of military life and securing your family's financial well-being. Call 1-877-398-2263 today or go to aafmaa.com to see how we can help you.
Steve Richardson saved the life of a kidnapped 5-year-old boy. William Borucki helped discover Earth-like planets 1,200 light-years away. And Dave Brumell has been called the Steve Jobs of the Social Security Administration. These individuals are among the 31 federal employees named finalists for this year's Service to America medals. The awards honor feds advancing the health, safety, and well-being of Americans. Hear interviews with each of the nominees and learn more about their work at federalnewsradio.com. Search Service to America.
Now your Federal News Radio DoD report brought to you by BAE Systems. Afternoons at 40 minutes past the hour. The Navy is stopping a program to develop new sensor equipment for unmanned aerial vehicles. The Navy says the system built by ITT Excellus is behind schedule and the department might look for new bids. Breaking Defense reports the Navy wants to give drones the ability to detect and avoid other aircraft while they're flying a mission. You get your DoD report brought to you by BAE Systems. Afternoons at 40 minutes past the hour on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week selected by Dan Mintz and Steve Bucci in their archive later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. We're up to
number one.
And Steve Bucci, your most important federal news story of the week is Mackenzie Wenger's story in Politico Pro. The headline is "The Cyber War Against the Media." And this is something, as we talked about a little bit during the break, that sometimes it takes a special incident to get certain people to pay attention, doesn't it?
It does. And, you know, cyber is so important, and it's such a critical issue for the federal audience, but for the whole country and the world, really. And I'm just glad that the media is finally getting attacked, so maybe the media will take this thing seriously. Now, they have run lots of stories, but it's usually total hype, and then they forget about it for another 6 months. Maybe with them starting to get targeted, some of the big news agencies have been getting hit, that they'll realize the kind of ongoing threat that this entails. And we talked at the break, this is like the effect of when you kill one journalist, everybody gets all upset, even though there's been 500 other people killed along the way. These attacks are all serious. They all need to be addressed, and hopefully we'll start doing it with a little more focus than we have in the past.
The New York Times got hammered again this week. They were offline for about 2 hours on Wednesday, I think it was.
Yeah.
And there's the memo went out in the newsroom there from what I read on one of the news media trade sites that they were very proud of the way that they continued distributing news on Facebook and Twitter and stuff. And I'm thinking, yeah, I bet only a very small fraction of your audience that comes to your main site knows that. And, you know, we shouldn't throw stones. You know, we were hacked over the summer, and so we've been through this ourselves. But I do think that what you're saying is interesting, and what this story hits on is interesting in that what does it take sometimes to really get the issues addressed? When you look at this, Dan, do you think my colleagues in the media do an adequate job of really explaining to people what the cyber threat landscape looks like, not just for the federal government, but more broadly across the private and public sector?
No. The problem here is it's the field is becoming so complicated. Well, there's a whole series of issues. The field is becoming so complicated that trying to bring in some fashion that people can deal with is hard right now. And the press, I suspect, is so distracted by just surviving and figuring out how to stay in business at all that their ability to keep sufficiently sophisticated writers to talk about this is probably pretty difficult. But no, in fact, I think people would be pretty disquieted if they were regularly reminded as to how easy it is to hack into, financial systems, utility systems, and of course the press. Here, it is interesting that the whole issue of how people regard the press and their role and providing information itself is a very interesting topic.
Regarding your comment about the press staying in business, I'll just go on the record as saying I'm in favor of that, and I hope that continues to be the case, especially one particular media outlet that I'm associated with. What do you have there, Steve?
Well, I in line with what Dan was just saying, the press does not do a good job getting the word out to the great American public about the real issues in cyber, and frankly, neither does the government. There's a hunger out there in the American public to know. They get in their gut there's a problem, but they don't know, is it a big existential problem?
Do you think they really do, though? I wonder sometimes.
Well, not every single person
out
there, but people that are aware of the connectivity that and the way we use technology today – they want to know. And the government, despite having a focus on awareness and education, they're just not reaching all the people. Every time I go outside of Washington and talk to folks, all anybody wants to ask me about is cybersecurity.
But do they want to ask you about cybersecurity in regards to what it means to their personal lives, or do they want to ask you bigger broader questions about cybersecurity, like why do the Chinese keep hacking us and stuff like that?
Both, really. They'd like to know the big picture. They want to understand that. They want to have a realistic view of that so they're not worrying when they don't have to and they're not, being Pollyanna when they should be concerned. But they also bring it to themselves. You know, what can they do to be better protected? What can they do to not be part of the problem?
Change your password from password. That's the first thing you can do.
There's a lot of real basic stuff that we should be teaching them that they should be doing. And there's just the word's not getting out in the way that it should, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm. How do we fix that?
How do we fix that?
Easy question, right?
Easy question.
It should only take an hour or so.
I'll choose to answer the question I can't answer or the comment I can't deal with. So extrapolating a little bit, I think part of the challenge that's going on right now is this, what the implications of some of this is part of the fact that growing numbers of people, not just well, around the world in general, but certainly even in this country, are losing faith in the accuracy and functionality of the institutions around them. If you do surveys of the average American citizen, their belief in the workings of their government, of many, many public institutions, are way down for a variety of reasons. And I think that people who do not believe that they control their own lives and that the institutions around them don't have credibility and can't be trusted, may do things that are and act in ways that are really unfortunate in the long term. So I think if we don't solve these kinds of problems and people can keep hacking into all these things, it just feeds into this lack of security, personal security that people seem to be feeling more.
Steve Bucci's most important federal news story of the week is from Politico Pro. The headline is The Cyber War Against the Media, and you can find a link to it at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth, like all the stories that we're counting down this week. That'll be up later this afternoon when we come back to wrap up this week's Federal News Countdown. Dan Mintz's selection for the most important federal news story of the week. It's next on Federal News Radio.
They say a picture is worth a thousand words. Well, picture your family and home safe and secure with Ackerman Security Systems. Picture yourself controlling your system remotely on your mobile phone anytime, anywhere. Picture yourself getting video clips and texts of happenings at home before your kids get home from school. Picture everything you can do with the money saved by choosing Ackerman Security.
There's good reason Ackerman Security Systems is the Washington area's most trusted security company. It's because at Ackerman, security is all they do, and they do it better than anyone else. For just $18.95 a month, Ackerman monitors your home for burglary, fire, and medical alert. Already have a system? Switch for free and start saving. Call by Wednesday and get up to 3 months of basic monitoring free. Call 888-999-1070. AckermanSecurity.com.
The Mobility Report is brought to you by CDWG.
About 1 in 3 people visiting federal agency websites do so using a smartphone. That's according to the consultancy 4C in its quarterly survey of 300,000 people visiting federal websites. The average level of customer satisfaction with the accessibility and usefulness of agency websites is 75%. That's according to the American Consumer Satisfaction Index. That 75% satisfaction level hasn't changed since 2009. I'm Sean McCauley.
The mobile workforce. There's no doubt they're mobile, but can they work? If you're in federal IT, that's up to you. Visit cdwg.com/mobility to see how they can keep your people productive and your network secure. Sounds like a win-win. CDWG. People who get it.
Visit CDWG.com to learn how Lenovo laptops can provide your mobile workforce with all the tools they need to work on the go.
Has sequestration and budget cuts made performing vital IT functions difficult for your agency? If so, it's time to explore another option with SUSE Linux, the open source leader. Save time and money by lowering the cost of your operating system and associated products with SUSE's expanded support program. It's the fastest way to save money on your next Linux renewal and lower the cost of licensing without changing any of your applications or systems. Learn more at SUSE.com/spendless. That's SUSE.com/spendless. Or purchase on SUPE through CDWG.
Government IT professionals, register today for the Executive Leadership Conference. This government-led education and training event hosted by the American Council for Technology and Industry Advisory Council features newly designed interactive workshops. Nationally prominent speakers from within government will share their freshest ideas and techniques for leveraging new technologies and data for mission success. October 27th through 29th in Williamsburg, Virginia. Register today at actgov.org. That's actgov.org.
We're back on In Depth with Francis Rose on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. The Federal News Countdown this week features the three most important federal news stories of the week as selected by Steve Bucci and Dan Mintz. And Dan Mintz's most important story of the week is from FCW. It's Amber Corin's story headlined, Leadership of Intel Review Group Remains Unclear. And the idea here is President Obama names a group of people who are going to oversee the privacy practices and other practices of the Intel community. But we don't really know much more about that now than we did then, do we?
Yeah. I just want to say this. We're commenting about offline how what an upper, I mean, that sarcastically this conversation's been. I just want to say I want to blame it on the fact that I was at the Nationals game last night and watched as a three-run homer cost it the top of the ninth.
And that's what made you harumph so much.
I'm just in a... So to give the background of the story, earlier this week, the president, you know, there's a connected to some of the things we've talked about, the problems with Snowden and NSA and all these issues. There's a concern that the American people have lost faith, or at least are very concerned about exactly, you know, are there enough safeguards around NSA? So earlier this week, the president published a memo saying that we'll appoint a time-honored tradition in Washington, a review committee.
Blue ribbon panel,
and that by December, they would come back and say how to solve that problem. And James Clapper, who was in charge of all this stuff, was told, set up this committee. But then there was a whole series of controversial nomination. So a lot of people, not me, but a lot of people said, well, he can't do that because he's too biased. How can you have the Fox appoint the committee to check out the chicken coop? So you have now the situation within a couple of days after the announcement of the memo that the White House is now saying it's appointing the committee that they asked Clapper to do, and that he's actually not going to have any responsibilities operationally or anything to do with the committee. And so you have the problem that this it's now very confusing as to you know, who's going to be in the committee, how's it going to be appointed, what's Clapper's role, and things like that. And I think, again, this is not just an issue of this administration making these decisions. It shows this enormous complexity that cybersecurity and the pervasiveness of networks are bringing to policy in general. And as we've talked about before, even with NSA, and NSA even organizationally has the complexity that Keith Alexander, who, you know, I've personally never met, but I've heard nothing but wonderful things about, is in this very complicated organizational situation where his left foot is in charge of a DOD part of responsibility, and his right foot is responsible for being in charge of NSA. And that might work as long as Keith Alexander's there. But from a policy point of view, is he setting up this intertwining between the two that someone else who is not as wonderful will be able to handle? So you have this enormous complexity going on, and people are trying to solve the problem without solving the underlying systemic problem.
Is there a way to make this more simple, Steve?
Well, I think as far as the panel that the story is focusing on, I think you can. I mean, General Clapper was never meant to be the committee chairman of it. They just put it under him because he's the guy who's going to have to open the doors to the systems and the programs that these people are going to need to see to do their job appropriately. I think this is just another example of really poor public relations work in how they packaged it and how they thought people would perceive it. But Dan's right, the complexity of our system is tough for people to understand. I agree with I have met General Alexander and think the world of him. And there was a large question when they set up Cyber Command and gave him command of that, in addition to being the director of NSA, of, okay, we all agree that he can do this, but who the heck else is going to do it next? Much bigger problem. I would predict that you're going to see those two entities split apart here in the future, and I doubt if U.S. Cyber Command's commander will be the director of NSA in the future. I think that's just a huge portfolio for anybody to manage, and one that is fraught with both complexity and danger.
The other thing, going back to the committee, it's not clear that you can put together a committee and have it report in 60 days with a series of initiatives that are going to untangle the kinds of problems that we're talking about. And that's it would make more sense to me to have perhaps a little bit longer horizon in terms of the appointment.
But that doesn't usually happen in these situations just because for political reasons. People right. want answers really fast.
And Congress gets very impatient. You know, they sit around and don't do much for a long period of time and then suddenly want to do everything in about a week, mostly because that's what's in the headlines. And in this case, they want that a week away solution. And this is too complex a set of issues that bumps into the key parts of the government's responsibility to protect both our civil liberties and our physical well-being. This is a tough one, and it should get the right kind of focus and attention so that we do it correctly and not do it just in response to emotion or to the news cycle.
I do want to clarify one point. My reference to this being a blue ribbon panel was my name for it and not anything official from the White House. But that's the syndrome that I wonder if it may be going on here is that we get these back. Say we do get results back from this in 90 days. Final recommendations no later than December 15th, 2013 is what General Clapper's memo said. Say we do have something by then. What happens to prevent it from just being another white paper that goes on a shelf somewhere and nobody reads?
I think there's a good chance that's in fact what's going to happen. We talked about...
So this won't make any difference in the long run.
I would be...
Potentially.
It's possible,
potential,
but I would be surprised. Yeah. Something we talked about earlier with some of the other articles about the necessity for education in general and speaking out to the public. For us to really solve these kinds of problems, we need a dialogue, in my opinion, in the public square, talking about what is in fact the role of security and cybersecurity and drones, which we talked about, and all these other capabilities. And that we need a little bit, I think, more consistent attention and messaging that so people understand how serious this is and how it will not go away.
Steve, last word.
The danger with this kind of committee is they're going to pick a bunch of graybeards, which is what they talked about, people with the wisdom and the experience to know these programs. Today is different than the era that those guys did their jobs in. And I think there's a danger that if we don't get some folks that understand the environment today and the feelings today, that we could really miss it with the results of this panel.
That's where we have to leave it on this week's Federal News Countdown. Dan Mintz's most important federal news story of the week is from Federal Computer Week. The headline is Leadership of Intel Review Group Remains Unclear. It and all of our stories on the countdown linked at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth later this afternoon. A fantastic effort on your first time out, Steve.
It's my pleasure.
We'll look forward
Thank
to
you.
Having you do it
Hope
again.
I can come back.
Dan Mintz, great to see you as always, my friend, and better luck at Nats Park. You going this weekend?
No, they're down
oh, they're on the road. Oh, they're on the road now. All right. Well, so that you knowing you might go anyway and just sit outside the park and cry. You can find the Federal News Countdown archive later today at federalnewsradio.com/in-depth. And hour number two of the program is coming next.